So I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me here and for what's shaping up to be a very, very nice conference. So,
but I should not speak during this thing.
So I'm going to talk about a recent paper I wrote together with Lance Dixon and Nigel Glover, and it's about MHV rules applied for amplitudes which involve massive Higgs bosons and gluons. So I subtitled it. Subtitle the talk, A Tale of Two Towers. We'll see why the two towers, where they will come from and why they will become important. I also would like to thank Freddy and Zvi for giving excellent talks before me and reviewing a lot of material, so this makes my job a little easier. Of course, now they covered an easy stuff, so I have to invent something reasonably complicated. So, now this. So this is an incomplete list of references related to this work. Papers in blue are the papers before the twister space was mentioned in this context, and papers in green are some of the related work on the subject. Right, I somehow can't see anything on the screen. So a brief review, perturbative amplitudes in conformal n equals 4 gauge theories in the limit of number of colors going to infinity can be interpreted as d-instanton contributions in topological string theory in twister space. And this was proposed by Witten in December last year. And then in March 2004, as we heard from Freddy's and Zvi's talk, Kachazos, Verschuk, and Witten, who will be referred from now on as CSW, proposed a new approach for calculating scattering amplitudes of n gluons in supersymmetric gauge theory and in QCD. Right, so the key idea is that the amplitudes in gauge theories are found by summing new scalar diagrams. The vertices of this new scalar perturbation theory are the MHV vertices. So these are the maximal helicity violating scattering amplitudes of Parkin-Taylor, which are then analytically continued off-shell in the manner we shall describe in a little while. And then these effective vertices are connected to each other by scalar propagators, 1 over Q squared. So the vertices, I call the vertices, just for the purposes of this talk, scalar vertices, because they don't carry any indices. Right? They don't carry any indices. These are the, if I would think in terms of Feynman diagrams, this would be already amplitude. So it's an amputated Green's function where each external line is multiplied by the corresponding wave function. So there are no outstanding indices, right? So in this sense, it looks like a scalar vertex. It has a helicity index, but all the helicity spinners are converted into the inner products. And then these vertices are connected by scalar propagators, which also don't carry any indices. So they're like 1 over Q squared, 1 over P squared. If you calculate loops with these diagrams, you have to put I epsilon prescription in the propagator. So this is the form of the MHV vertex in gauge theory. So it's a vertex calculated at a tree level. It's a Parkin-Taylor formula. It has only two negative helicity gluons, R and S. All other gluons are of positive helicity. What's important, and this was, of course, reviewed already in previous talks, that this amplitude depends only on the angular inner products, right? So it depends only on the angular inner product of lambda R with lambda S and does not depend on the square inner product. So it depends only on the so-called holomorphic inner products. So it's a very simple formula. It depends only on the holomorphic spinner products. And it depends, and it's written down for the arbitrary number of gluons. So this is where we can get savings on the numbers of Feynman diagrams we need to calculate. And then in order to be able to use this MHV vertices in the scalar diagrams, you need to continue the propagators of shell. So the external lines which will be connected by the scalar propagators have to be continued off shell, and the prescription for continuing off shell these external lines was designed by the CSW. So this is a very, very brief reminder for the third time today of the helicity spinner basis. So every on-shell momentum, so every momentum of an on-shell massless particle such as p squared is equal to zero, can be written down as a product of two commuting spinners, two component spinners, lambda and lambda tilde. Then you define the angular spinner product, which is a product of lambdas in this way, and you define the square spinner product, which is a product of lambda tildes in this way. So I have a minus one convention compared to Witten and CSW, and this convention follows the more standard QCD literature. Actually, from paper to paper, we change conventions. So this is again the MHV amplitude written down. So it has the Park and Taylor form, and it has explicit dependence on the coupling constant, and it has a delta function of momentum conservation. And in order to find the interpretation of this amplitude in twister space, we keep spinners lambda, not tilted spinners, unchanged, and the tilted spinners, so spinners with tildes, which enter only in the momentum conservation delta functions, are traded for their Fourier transform variables. So you do this half Fourier transformation, and that's how you get to the twister space, and then the twister space amplitude is supported on a line. So the MHV vertex is supported on a line. And this is very briefly, when you put together two MHV amplitudes in order to calculate an N MHV amplitude. So this amplitude, this was one MHV amplitude, it had two minuses, two and three. So it had two negative helicities, all others were positive. And this had two negative helicities, minus and the minus over here. You connect the two vertices by a propagator. The propagator has to connect plus to a minus because all the lines are considered to be, let's say, incoming. Right, and then we get a non-MHV amplitude, which is an amplitude with three negative helicities, three, two, and one. So these are all three different classes of scalar non-Feynman diagrams you would have to calculate if you were computing a process with n gluons and two fermions. I just did two fermions for fun. And the fermion line here is denoted by a dashed line. And now this is the issue of a Fourier, this is the issue of an off-shell continuation. If you need to define a helicity spinner lambda for the off-shell leg, you just take the corresponding off-shell momentum, Q alpha alpha dot, and this off-shell momentum is a sum of all the incoming on-shell momentum. So if this is a Q, this line, and it will be a sum of all of this incoming on-shell momenta, and you then multiply this Q alpha alpha dot by a reference spinner, which I call Xi reference alpha dot in here. So sometimes it's called mu, sometimes it's called eta. Here it's called Xi. This is the CSW off-shell continuation. Right, and all the on-shell lambdas are defined in the usual way. And when you calculate the final amplitude, the dependence on the reference spinner will disappear from the gauge invariant results for the amplitudes. So, the summary of what we've learned so far. So, when you perform calculations with this new effective scalar theory at a tree level, you have a dramatic savings on the number of Feynman diagrams you need to compute because you are basically using the vertices, which already are n-particle vertices, right? The CSW approach had been extended to amplitudes with fermions, and at a tree level, the supersymmetry is irrelevant. So, if you were only interested in calculating tree amplitudes with massless particles in an arbitrary gauge theory, this theory did not have to be supersymmetric for this scalar perturbation theory to work. Now, what happens at the loop level? So it turns out, due to this calculation performed by Brandhuber, Spence, and Travaglini mentioned in the earlier talks, that you can use this MHV rules also at one Luk level in n equals 4 theory. So now you take one tree-level MHV vertex and another tree-level MHV vertex, and you connect them now by two propagators so that you form a loop. The propagators have to have a correct epsilon prescription, but so that these are final propagators, but otherwise these are scalar propagators. BHS or Brandhuber, Spetz, and Travaglini perform the calculation for the simplest amplitude, which is a one-loop amplitude in n equals 4 super Young Mills, which is an MHV amplitude, right? So it has only two negative helicity, an arbitrary number of positive helicities. And they found a complete agreement with the 1994 calculation of Byrne, Dixon, Dunbar, and Coswell. And then this approach was also shown to work for amplitudes in n equals 1 super Young Mills. Furthermore, the holomorphic anomaly approach reviewed in the talk of Cacciaso makes further very important simplifications for supersymmetric gauge theories. So if you want to compute one loop amplitudes in supersymmetric gauge theories, you actually don't have to compute the loops. You use the fact that that all the amplitudes at one loop level in any supersymmetric gauge theories are cut constructible. So in other words, four-dimensional helicities propagating on the internal lines in the loop. So you don't need to work in D dimension on the intermediate lines. And because of it, there are major simplifications. So the holomorphic anomaly approach works in the way that you know that the one loop result for an n equals four amplitude is going to be a linear combination of the scalar box functions which are known times the coefficients which are generically not known, right? And all you have to do is to compute the coefficients, and by applying a judiciously chosen differential operators acting on the full amplitude, you can reduce the integration in the loop to an integral which acts on a delta function, which comes from the holomorphic anomaly. So in this way, you actually don't have to perform a loop integral. And so what I want to emphasize here is that, first of all, the calculations of the coefficients and as such of the full amplitudes at the 7-point level were performed in two different ways, one by Cacciaso and Brito, Cacciaso, and Feng, using the holomorphic anomaly approach when you don't actually calculate loops, and one in this heroic computation of Zvi and his friends, where they use a unitarity approach, and the results are in complete agreement, at least for the consecutive helicity cases which were calculated by Cacciaso and collaborators. So as it already mentioned by Zvi, that this impressive progress in supersymmetric gauge theories is related to the fact, probably, that all these amplitudes, all these one-loop amplitudes in supersymmetric gauge theories are cut constructible. So things are going to become more complicated if we consider non-supersymmetric theories. So in a non-supersymmetric case, you can have a one-loop amplitude. So this is a one amplitude in pure Galois dynamics, which has less than two negative helicities. So this is less than MHV, or more than MHV, depending on how you count it. So if the theory was supersymmetric, the amplitude with non-only one negative helicity gluon would have to vanish by supersymmetry. But the theory is non-supersymmetric, so these amplitudes are there. How are you going to compute them? If you were trying to compute these amplitudes using the cut constructibility approach, you would find out that these amplitudes are not cut constructible. So you cannot, they're not cut constructible in the sense that you cannot use a four-dimensional helicities. So you cannot use particles with four-dimensional particles on the loop propagating in a four-dimensional space. So these amplitudes are, well, they're going to appear on the next transparency. They are actually, in four dimensions, they are cut-free rational functions of kinematic variables, so they contain no cuts. So this is This is the one. So most of the talk, most of the remaining parts of the talk is going to be, well, I'm going to be trying to address this important issue of what to do with one loop amplitudes in a non-supersymmetric theory, which is plagued by the appearance of this amplitudes with less than two negative helicities. Right, so if you inspect the amplitude with all pluses at one loop in pure gliodynamics, it has this structure. So it has a standard denominator. There's a simple structure. It has a denominator which depends only on the angular spin of products, and then it has something in the numerator which is quadratic in angular spin of products and quadratic in a square spin of products. If you compare this amplitude to the amplitude in the standard model, which is an amplitude of a massive Higgs plus n gluons, right? So this was an n gluon amplitude, and this is a massive Higgs plus n gluon amplitude in the limit where the top quark mass is much greater than the Higgs boson mass. It has a very similar structure. So why am I talking about the top mass here? This is a one-loop amplitude, which is obtained by Higgs first decaying into a loop of a top quark. So there's a loop of a top quark mediating the decay of a Higgs into n gluons. This is in the large top mass limit, this is a dominant process of a Higgs to n gluons amplitude, right? And it's a one-loop amplitude. It has a very similar structure to this one. This amplitude also doesn't have negative helicities, right? So it cannot be treated by the standard CSW MHV rules. And maybe if we learn how to treat these amplitudes, we can learn something about how to deal with these amplitudes. And so what we've learned is how to extend construct a different version of MHV rules, which enables you to take into account the amplitudes of Higgs going to n gluons. And this does not immediately answer all the questions about what to do with non-supersymmetric loops, but it provides some ideas in the general case. Basically, the major difference between these two types of the amplitude is that this amplitude was dominated by a loop of a heavy top quark, so it was an amplitude in a non-supersymmetric theory with a massive loop, and this is an amplitude with a massless loop. And the way we are going to treat these types of amplitudes is going to take into account the fact that the loop was massive. Right, but I'm getting ahead of myself slightly. So the CSW in their second paper, in order to understand what to do with this amplitudes with less than two negative helicities, made a very interesting attempt, right, to resolve the problem. They suggested to use the one loop amplitude with only positive helicities as a new building blocks. So this would be additional amplitudes in addition to the three-level Parkey-Taylor amplitudes, which you would add to your perturbation theory. And then by combining, let's say, an amplitude with all classes, which are here four positive helicities, with a standard three-level MHV amplitude, which has two negative helicities and one positive helicity. So you would combine these two amplitudes by propagating, it would connect plus to a minus, which will become an internal line, and then you would get plus, 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 and one minus and another plus. So you would get four pluses and one minus as a one loop, as a proposal for your one loop result. So this expression is known. These expressions are known. You combine the two, and you don't get an agreement. We performed a similar test in the Higgs model. In this case, there is an even simpler amplitude where Higgs can decay into two gluons with positive helicities. Right? This is a smallest amplitude. It's a two-point gluon amplitude, a three-point amplitude altogether. You combine it with a three-point standard three-level MHV amplitude in order to get an amplitude of Higgs to one negative helicity gluon and two positive helicity gluons, and we fail again. Just like CSW, we're not able to follow this calculation. So, in fact, the results which we get in this approach turn out to be even gauge variant. So we get a dependence on the reference spin all over the place. This cannot be the right approach. We tried also to do some more complicated calculations, but basically trying to use the amplitude with all classes of Higgs and all classes as new building blocks, and it just doesn't work. So you need to modify or invent a new extension of the CSW MHV rules in a, you know, in a more drastic way, and that's what we are going to do. And okay. So what's the motivation for studying the Higgs plus gluon amplitudes? So on the one hand, it's important to extend the range of processes which can be treated by the MHV rules from massless QCD, right? Zvi and Freddy talked about massless QCD all the way through, or sometimes massless N equals 4 theory. But we need to include massive particles, right? There are massive Ws and Zs and tops and Higgses. So including the mass effect for the Higgs, it's the first simplest but important thing you have to do, right? So we want to create MHV rules for massive particles. So the momentum of the Higgs is not null. It's equal to the square of momentum is m Higgs squared. Higgs plus gluon amplitudes come from one loop effects in a non-supersymmetric standard model. So maybe what we will learn here can be used for developing MHV rules for non-supersymmetric loops. Now I have to be careful here in the following way, that this Higgs plus n gluon amplitudes can come from a supersymmetric standard model or can come from a non-supersymmetric standard model. So the theory does not have to be non-supersymmetric. But I'm allowed to consider a non-supersymmetric theory, and then these amplitudes are present, right? So, and the fourth point in the motivation is that this process is of phenomenological importance, because the gluon fusion into a Higgs is probably going to be the dominant process for the standard model Higgs production at the Hadron Collider, such as Tevatron and LHC. And the approximation which we are going to use for the twice the top mass being greater, that is, the signs are wrong. So the twice the top mass being greater than the Higgs mass and integrating the top mass loop out is going to be a good approximation. So we can integrate the heavy top quark, which will be described in more detail in the next transparency, and summarize the effect of this one loop massive diagram by an effective dimension 5 operator of the Higgs. So it's a Higgs times trace G mu, where G mu is the gluon field strength. And this effective operator was discussed by Weinstein, Zaharov, and Schiffman. It was discussed by Voloshin. It was discussed by Wilczek in the 70s. So we'll provide a set of all MHV new MHV rules for such amplitudes, which involve Higgs and then gluons, and fully resolve this problem. So how am I doing this time? I have about 20 minutes. Okay, thank you. So this is a process. So we had a Higgs emitting a top loop, and then the final states are gluons. So in other words, there is a Higgs to n gluons with an intermediate top quark loop. You can integrate the top quark loop and represent this effect as a tree-level, as now a tree-level interaction, but it's a tree-level effective vertex, right, of dimension 5, which is just H Higgs times trace G mu, and the constant here, which I'll set to 1, takes in the standard model this value, right? So the point is that if you try to write down an MHV rules directly for this vertex, right, without splitting it into parts, without doing anything, you're going to fail. So the method which we created for this, so it was found by actually doing various types of calculations and then finding which of them are going to work, which of them are going to produce first gauge invariant results and then agree with the known formulae. We found the method and then we found the reason for the method. So the idea is to split the effective interaction H trace G mu into two parts, which we'll call a holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic part. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to introduce a complex scalar field phi, which has a real part H and imaginary part A, right? And I'm going to consider an interaction which is HGG plus A times GG dual. So in perturbation theory, G times G dual is a total derivative. So if A was a constant, like a heat, if A was not a field but was a constant, it would make no effects in perturbation theory. When A is a field, this is a pseudoscalar. This is a pseudoscalar meson. So I can add this interaction. It's not going to spoil anything as far as I'm interested in the Higgs. And then this combination, H times trace GG plus IA trace GG dual, can be rewritten in this form. So the first term involves a complex scalar phi, so I'll call it a holomorphic field phi, times G self dual, plus the other term is phi dagger trace G anti self dual, G anti self dual. So this is an equality. Right? So this is an identity. And G self dual is introduced as G mu nu plus G mu nu dual, and in Minkowski space I define G mu nu dual with a factor of I. Right? In such a way that everything is fine. This splitting of the interaction can also be embedded into a supersymmetric theory. So obviously I can embed these two terms into a superpotential term plus a Hermitian conjugate of the superpotential, where the superpotential is made out of n equals 1 chiral superfield phi and n equals 1 chiral field strength superfield w's. This is where it's coming from. The interaction I considered in the previous transparency was non-supersymmetric, but I can now embed it into a supersymmetric theory if I wish. It's not going to be very important, but this just provides some motivation or provides some structure in what we are doing. Now, W, the field strength superfield W, depends only on F mu nu, on G mu nu, sorry, self-dual, and W bar depends on anti-self-dual field strength. Self-dual field strengths correspond to gluons or produce gluons of negative helicity, right? So the W's, the chiral superfield W, depends on self-dual G mu nu's, and they correspond to negative helicity gluons, and then their super partners are going to be negative helicity gluinos. So they would have helicity minus 1/2. So phi in components has a scalar field. Phi is the lowest component, and then it has a fermion or Higgsian of psi minus, and then W bars and phi dagger would have positive helicities. Now, it can be shown now that an amplitude, so you see, I have gotten rid of Higgs's. I'm not looking at Higgs's. I'm looking instead at the amplitudes which involve a complex field phi with gluons and complex field phi dagger with gluons. So it can be shown that whenever I look at the amplitude with phi and almost all positive gluons, these amplitudes are equal to zero identically, right? This can be shown in different ways. One way to show it is to show it to all orders in perturbation theory at a tree level using Behrens-Gille recursive currents, right? This can also be shown using supersymmetric word identities. On the other hand, the same amplitude, the amplitude with the same mostly positive gluons and a phi dagger field is not equal to zero, right? So the amplitudes with phi, the first non-vanishing amplitude with phi will actually have to contain precisely two negative helicity gluons. So let me just remind you where we started from. We started from the fact that the amplitude with the Higgs could exist when the Higgs was decaying to all positive helicity gluons, so no negative helicity gluons, it existed. But after we split the interaction into a phi part and a phi dagger part, the amplitude with less than two negative helicity gluons could not exist as far as it was an amplitude with phi. And the first non-vanishing amplitude would have to have precisely two negative helicity gluons. So it looks very much like an old MHV amplitude, but it's an amplitude with a phi, so we'll call it phi MHV amplitudes. They're first non-vanishing ones. Well, the same amplitudes for phi daggers are non-vanishing even for fewer negative helicity gluons. So if we write down the list of amplitudes, first non-vanishing amplitudes, these are known results from previous papers by Dawson and Kaufman. So an amplitude, a two-point amplitude of phi to two negative helicity gluons has these forms. Two negative helicity gluon with one positive helicity gluon. Two negative helicity gluons with two positive helicity gluons. What you discover is that they have exactly the same form as the MHV tree-level amplitudes in pure QCD, except that these are all n plus one amplitudes. And so it's not just an amplitude for n gluons, it's an amplitude for n gluon plus a massive Higgs. So there is a momentum conservation which is different. So all the sum of the over the n momentum of n gluons is now not going to be equal to zero, it's going to be equal to p Higgs. And p Higgs squared is m Higgs squared. Otherwise, the form is exactly the same as in the MHV pure glue case. So it's easy to conjecture and even to prove, but we haven't gone through the details of the proof, that a general endpoint amplitude with a phi and two negative helicity gluons and any number of positive helicity gluons would have this form, which is exactly the, as I mentioned earlier, exactly the same form as in the MHV, as the MHV amplitude in the tree-level pure glue, apart from the momentum conservation. Because you have to remember that the amplitudes with phi daggers also exist and have different form. So that's the first tower which is appearing. So now on this plot on the vertical axis we have the various geometrical symbols on this plot correspond to amplitudes, right? So on the vertical line we have number of positive helicity gluons plus number of negative helicity gluons in the amplitude, also known as n, the total number of gluons. So this line corresponds to all possible six gluon amplitudes with the phi, and these are five gluon amplitudes with the phi, and these are four gluon amplitudes, etc. And on the horizontal axis, I have number of positive helicity gluons minus number of the negative helicity gluons. So the solid red dots are the phi MHV amplitudes. This amplitude has phi with two negative helicity gluons, no positive ones, two negative helicity gluons, one positive one, two negative helicity gluons, two positive ones, etc. Then you take these amplitudes, you combine them in the CSW fashion with the standard tree-level MHV amplitudes, and then you get to the second row, or whatever it is, to the second diagonal, which would correspond to the amplitudes with three negative minuses. So these were amplitudes with two negative helicities. These are amplitudes with three negative helicities, four, five, six, etc. And then it can continue. And so the rule of the game is to combine phi MHV vertex, one phi MHV vertex with tree-level pure glue MHV vertices, and get non-MHV. But then you have to remember about phi dagger. So here we have the second tower appearing, something which we didn't have in the CSW case. So the solid green dots now correspond to phi dagger amplitudes with two positive helicity gluons and any number of negative ones, right? So this would be the simplest amplitude of phi dagger going to G plus and no G minuses. And then the number of G minuses increase, right? And these amplitudes are obtained from the other ones by parity or Hermitian conjugation. And then if you want to construct an amplitude with three pluses, here they are, and you combine them by taking one of these and combining them with an anti-MHV vertices. An anti-MHV vertices in tree-level gauge theory were the vertices with precisely two positive helicity gluons and no negative ones. So this is an important new point, right? Which is that we need to use MHV and anti-MHV vertices in the same time. In the CSW approach, you would stick to the, in the standard CSW approach, you would stick to MHV vertices and you would never use anti-MHV vertices. Anti-MHV vertices would be reproduced from the MHV vertices. They are not independent building blocks. Here, the anti-MHV vertices are independent building blocks, but in such a way that you never combine MHV with anti-MHV. You combine MHVs with MHVs, get a red tower in the previous transparency. You combine anti-MHVs with anti-MHVs, get a green tower, and then you add them. And you add them because the Higgs is equal to phi plus phi dagger, possibly up to a factor of 2. Right, so these are the amplitudes for the Higgs going to N gluons. Right, and then these amplitudes for the Higgs are the two pictures which was the two pictures from the previous transparency superimposed. So if I look at this amplitude with two negative with the Higgs and two negative helicity gluons and no positive helicity gluons, it's just the standard phi MHV and nothing else. This is phi anti MHV. But if I go here to the amplitude with two positive and two negative helicity gluons, it gets contribution from both towers. Yeah, so just summarize again, the rule of the game is that each tower is built out of amplitudes of the same type, either holomorphic or anti-holomorphic. So either MHVs or anti-MHVs. But then, depending on the amplitude you look at, you may have to sum them. So this is the first amplitude in the overlap. It's pretty trivial. This amplitude in the overlap is less trivial because it contains, on the anti-MHV side, it contains a solid green dot, which was a phi dagger anti-MHV amplitude. So that's a building block. But on the red side, it has an empty red circle. So it's something which was obtained from phi MHV amplitudes combined with the tree-level MHV. So I hope you can still follow. But these pictures illustrate precisely what happens. So you have two towers, you have to combine them. So now we need to test the approach and see what we get. So these are the rules which I summarized before. And what we can get from this, we can calculate the Higgs amplitudes to N gluons. And if N, the number of gluons, is less than 5, then these amplitudes have been obtained before. They're known. And actually, the amplitude of the Higgs to 5 gluons was derived in a paper which appeared this summer using standard methods, which we'll see later on, by Del Duca, Friso, and Maltoni. But then, with our rules, we can go beyond 5 gluons, for example, to 6 gluons. This calculation has not been yet performed, but it can be done. I'll also show you how to compute certain amplitudes to certain amplitudes with certain helicity configurations to all orders. A brief comment on the twister space interpretation. You have seen that actually in all of these three talks, the calculations are done in field theory. The twister space is mentioned as an interpretation and as a guide. Actually, it's a very important guide because without twister space, we wouldn't have these rules. At the same time, the actual calculations are done in field theory in Minkowski space. The same is going to be here. But what is the twister interpretation? Is the fact that the Higgs was massive, is it going to affect the fact that the MHV amplitudes align on the line? Well, no. If you perform the Fourier transformation to the twister space only of the spinners which belong to the gluons, so the gluons which have massless on-shell momenta are represented in terms of lambda and lambda tildes. Lambda tildes are Fourier transformed to mu's. And the momentum of the Higgs is left untouched. And in this way, going through the standard argument of Witten, you find out that the amplitude is still supported on the line. So more precisely what happens, there was an amplitude which depended, this was a phi MHV amplitude. It depended only on lambdas, no lambda tildes. This is a delta 4 of momentum conservation. We will perform Fourier transformations with respect to lambda tildes, but only of gluons. So k phi will be left untouched. You rewrite the delta function as e to the I x times the argument of the delta function, leave x times k phi untouched, and the rest you just perform the integral over lambda tilde and get a delta function of mu I plus x lambda I. And this is an equation of a line in twister space. So the phi MHV amplitude would vanish unless all of its external gluon points transformed into twister space are living on the same line. Similarly, phi dagger anti-MHV amplitude, the one which is obtained by parity of Hermitian conjugation, is also living on the line, but in the anti-twister space, where lambda tildes were left in peace and lambdas were Fourier transformed. And all the rules for doing NMHV amplitudes, right, with more than two negative helicities, etc., work in exactly the same way as before. And these amplitudes are localized now on networks of intersecting lines. So what you can calculate are next to MHV amplitudes with three minuses. Phi goes to three minuses in any number of pluses. These are blue dots. Then we can calculate next to MHV amplitudes. Phi is four minuses in any number of pluses. These are these things. And then we also can calculate all minus-only amplitudes. So this would be the amplitudes which are living on this line. You can calculate anything, but these are the three things, the three classes of the diagrams we have calculated to convince ourselves that it works. This whole transparency is a full result for the amplitudes of a phi going to two minuses in any number of pluses. That's all what there is. The amplitude would be made out of phi MHV vertex and an ordinary MHV vertex. So the phi MHV vertex is this thing, with a dashed line representing the phi, and a solid line is a negative helicity gluons. I don't show positive helicity gluons, so these are the skeleton quiver diagrams. And the solid vertex is a standard MHV diagram, and you can have either the Higgs diagram on the Higgs vertex on the left or on the right. There are only two diagrams. These are the two answers, right? You just write them down immediately by using the MHV rules with the CSW of shell continuation. You write it immediately, you don't have to think about it. All you have to think about is how to sum these diagrams over all positive helicity gluons. So what I mean by this is that there can be N1 positive helicity gluons here, and N2 on the other side, and then N1 plus N2 should be equal to 2N, so N plus 2. So you have to sum over partitioning the positive helicity gluons living on the left, on the right. These are the sums. And these are the two answers, right, where D's are defined like this. That's the full result. This is the full result for three minuses with any number of pluses. Now, if you have three minuses with no pluses, the result simplifies to this expression. If you have three minuses with one plus, we check that numerically our result is gauge invariant and that it numerically agrees with the previously known expression, which takes this form. Tests are performed numerically because there are many, many ways of how to write down the same analytic expression in terms of the spin of variables. So it just makes, instead of struggling with spinor algebra, you can just check that your spinor inner product expression agrees with the expression known before. So in this case, we don't, for this very simple amplitudes, we don't get really savings on the final results compared to the standard. Oops. So we can also compute the amplitudes in the overlap of two towers, and there is an amplitude with plus plus minus minus, which was this one. It's just the sum of the phi MHV with phi anti MHV, and then we compute the slightly more complicated one, which is this one. And the slightly more complicated is computed here. And I guess I should mention that our result for the two pluses and three minuses is the Higgs, has just 12 terms. So the answer is 12, sum of 12 simple terms. If you look at the equation B3 of this paper, you will see three pages of, the final result is expressed as three pages. I'm not going to show it, but I can point you in the paper. So there's a considerably simple expression. If you go to higher and higher order calculations, you will find simpler and simpler you'll find more complicated expressions, of course, but you would find that your results are much simpler than what you would be finding if you were doing more standard calculations, Feynman diagram calculation. Now, I don't have time for this, but these are the type of diagrams you would need to calculate if you compute phi to three negative helicity gluon. Phi to four negative helicity gluons an arbitrary number of positive ones. There are 13 diagrams. It's a 5 plus 3 plus 5. You calculate them directly. There's a first 5. There's a second 3. There's a last 5. You get your expression, which is again not very complicated. It's non-analytically, right? You check that it's gauge invariant. You compare it to the simplest cases, x to 4 negative helicities, or x to 4 negative helicity gluons and 1 positive helicity gluons, and you get agreement with the known results. So we reproduced all the known results for Higgs to gluons, because they are known only up to Higgs plus 5 gluons. But we can do more. We have also derived an expression for phi going to an arbitrary number of minuses. I'm not going to spend time on it, but what we use here are recursive methods, somewhat similar to the methods mentioned in Zvi's talk. We've calculated all of those. So where are we now? So we constructed and tested a novel set of MHV rules for calculating scattering amplitudes of a massive Higgs plus an arbitrary number of gluons. So we don't know how to include large numbers of massive particles, but we know how to include one of them, as far as it's a scalar. One step at a time. So in principle, there is nothing in this method which applies only to a massless particle. So the particle can be a Higgs. So we know from the past experience that this method, the MHV rules method, is extremely powerful when you calculate trees. It's powerful when you calculate trees because the hardest thing in calculating trees is to get all these Feynman diagrams, to sum all the Feynman diagrams. So here, you're not doing Feynman diagrams, you have a major savings on combinatorics. If you were doing the loop integral, then unless you can use the holomorphic anomaly approach, then you have to do loops as well. And then so hard to do loops. So our idea was to start with a massive loop, integrate the massive loop out, that was a loop of a massive top, get an effective theory, but treat this effective theory at a tree level, and use the power of tree level results. Right, so the model is a tree level pure gauge theory plus an effective interaction, which arises from integrating the top loop out. We split interaction into two parts in order to derive the rules. We get compact formulae for the Higgs plus multipartons. This structure may be very useful for going to the next level in QCD, which is adding another loop or adding a first loop to the tree-level interaction, which we considered. So I mentioned before that this model is interesting and important on its own right because it talks about the Higgs, and it's related to the to the Higgs production through gluon fusion plus, in this case, extra parton jets. But we also believe that this model gives important insights into the structure of the MHV rules in generic non-supersymmetric theories at loop level. In the last transparency, again, our construction was designed to address effective interactions at the tree level. We can address massive loops in a non-supersymmetric theory. What's important is that the rules which we constructed or extended from CSW is not an entirely trivial extension. It uses the two towers, in this case, of MHV and anti-MHV diagrams. So without having this simple toy model with the Higgs, it would be hard to invent what's the structure of new building blocks which you need to add to your theory if you want to consider loops in a non-supersymmetric theory. And we expect that our findings will be useful also for massless loops in non-supersymmetric theories. Last thing I'll say before ending is that we also considered another effective theory, not with a Higgs, but an effective theory which has G mu nu, trace of G mu nu cube. So it's another effective interaction. We analyzed it in a similar way by splitting G mu nu's into self-dual and anti-self-dual parts, coming to a different two towers of MHV and anti-MHV diagrams, and again getting correct results. So we think we have a method which is working for massive loops in non-supersymmetric theory. So, but obviously more things need to be learned.
Thank you. We have some time for questions, but remember that we immediately after this we have a discussion of the topic. So, any questions? I do not see one.
Here's one.
Here.
With regard to some of the features that you mentioned in this particular model, you sort of emphasize the fact that there's this self-dual and self-dual structure mm-hmm. sort of embedded in the fact that you can write this in a nice holomorphic supersymmetric form. If you go to the next order in mt squared over mh squared over mt squared, what happens?
Well, good question. What would happen is that you would get a higher derivative interaction, of course, right, involving more powers of g mu, and an extra suppression with mt squared. You would try to split this we haven't analyzed it in detail, but you would try to split this interaction again in terms of purely self-dual pieces and purely anti-self-dual pieces. You might find that there are some mixed terms which would involve self-dual times anti-self-dual g menus, and then you would have to think hard what to do with it. So it's a serious issue. And if we always could integrate the loops, massive loops, out to all orders in 1 over mt, we would probably know what to do when the loop was massless. So at the moment, we know how to do the first term. There is a related question to yours. What would happen if we had more than one Higgs and any number of gluons? Then you might discuss, so let's say if you had two Higgses and you rewrite your interaction in terms of purely holomorphic and anti-holomorphic vertex. So sometimes you would have phi with gluons. It's fine, it's because it's MHV. Sometimes you would have phi dagger with gluons, which is fine, but sometimes you might have phi dagger. And if these terms are present, you need to think hard, because you would end up combining MHVs with anti-MHVs, and any attempts so far, tried by a number of people, including ourselves, did not work. Whenever you have to combine MHV with anti-MHV, these tricks of off-shell continuations do not work. But there might be miracles in this game, because this is not a standard perturbation theory, and it is not even derived from the Lagrangian. Right, I wrote down this vertex in the Lagrangian and split it into two parts to motivate the structure. But these things are not derived from the Lagrangian. So maybe there is a miracle, and you always can, you always would find that there is no overlap. I mean, there are no mixed terms between holomorphic and anti-holomorphic